The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you, Shireen. Thank you for coming for this session. Hopefully we'll have a nice discussion. We'll try to keep it in half an hour. We'd just like to thank the ISO for inviting me. This conference has been for me absolutely amazing, learning a lot. And hopefully I can try on my side to have an exchange that will benefit all of us. So to try to keep it in half an hour is going to be quite hard. But to speak about the Syrian revolution, the Kurdish issue, etc., is not something easy. So I won't be able to some extent, to enter in deep details. So after in the discussion, maybe if you want to have more info on some issues, obviously we can talk about it. So first of all, I think it's important to understand that the Kurdish population is not homogeneous. Very often we speak about the Kurds. As any kind of other ethnic population, you have different political parties, you have Kurds from different religious sect, although the majority is from Sunni background, that are divided in four countries, basically. Iran, Syria, Iraq, and Turkey. And they have suffered oppression in these four states since the establishment of these states. And I will concentrate on the case of Syria, even though obviously there are links to be made between the different countries. In the case of Syria, we have to know, first of all, that the population of Kurds, also is very debatable, is between 8 to 15%, to 2 to 3 million, 2 to 3 million inhabitants are around among a population of 22 to 24 million of Syrian people. Geographically speaking, well, this is also one of the differences in Syria, is that they are not located in only one area. They are not a majority in any kind of canton, if you want, or region. They are spread in different areas, the majority being in the Jazira, which is the northeast of Syria, where they reach between 45 to 50% northeast of Syria. They are, as you heard about it, I think Kobani, it's also in the north, and Afrin. But you do have half of the population of Kurds in Syria used to live in Aleppo and Damascus until the uprising. So these also are understandings that are quite different than Turkey or Iraq or even Iran to this extent. And I think this is something to keep in mind when we treat the Kurdish issue in the Syrian case. I'll briefly talk about the history of the Kurdish issue. This is a bit annoying, is it fine? Kurdish issue before 2011, because it's important to understand the history of oppression against Kurds. Since the establishment of the state of Syria in 1946, the independence of Syria, and to some extent we could go back even during the French mandate with also opposition between the Arab National Movement, if you want, the leadership, and the Kurdish issue, but I won't go into details on this issue. Following the 1946, it's important to understand that even the oppression of Kurds started before the arrival of the Baath Party in 1963 or before Hafez Assad arrived to power in 1970. So you had policies of oppression against Kurds, institutional racism at all levels, regarding languages, schools, not able to speak their own languages. What is interesting to know is that at the beginning, most of the Kurds entered the Syrian Communist Party, and it was known in Syria as the Kurdish Party. And actually, the head of the Syrian Communist Party, which has a long Stalinist history and catastrophic history, Khaled Bagdash, was from Kurdish origin but had been Arabized. Not forcefully, because you had a long history also of Arabization of Kurdish population, especially in Damascus or Aleppo, old families. And it was well known as the Kurdish political party in Syria, and they launched a lot of movement, especially regarding peasants in the northeast of Syria, challenging the power of feudals regarding social justice issue, democracy, And the only thing they didn't were not able to challenge was the oppression against Kurds, actually. And progressively, Kurds starting to leave the party. To give you an example, the Syrian Communist Party in the northeast of Syria had different newspapers in Arabic and in Armenian, but they refused to publish a newspaper in Kurdish, saying this is Kurdish nationalism, etc., while we want to keep and really going into this kind of entering this kind of not like the Baath Party later, but some form of Arab chauvinism. So refusing any kind of solidarity with Kurdish population regarding oppression of the state against Kurdish population. And going in the 60s, the same Communist Party started to, yeah, they supported the various military campaigns against Kurdish population in Iraq, which the Syrian regime participated in it. So at the end of 50s, you had progressively Kurds leaving the party, even though they still exist a bit, but the far majority left the Syrian Communist Party and established their own political parties. And even during the Wahde, the unity between...
Can we try without the mic? There's the
feedback. Yeah, no, it's...
Try tilting it down.
If I speak like this, it's fine?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, sorry. What is the Syrian way? Huh? So at the end of the 50s, even during the unity between Egypt and Syria, Kurds suffered harsh repression in the 60s with thousands of people, in the 60s, sorry, thousands of people imprisoned by the regime. So you had in 60s, 70s, until today, harsh repression when it comes to language, schools not being able to speak even their own languages on their workplace, wedding, etc. Also, you had policies of Arab colonization, the Arab Belt, that was called, that it was pushing out some Kurdish peasants from certain areas, replacing them by Arab peasants. So I won't go into details, but this policy started from the 60s, and the Kurds were generally presented as, you know, they were the scapegoats of Arab nationalism. They were the new Zionists. They used to be called, you know, the Zionists, the Israelis, etc. Within Syria, being, you know, supported by foreign powers to divide the Arab nation. So anyone that used to proclaim itself as Kurdish was basically a tool of imperialism against the willingness of the Arabs to establish one nation. And this kind of discourse, unfortunately, was once more and a few times in history used once again. One famous Democrat in Syria recently used this kind of vocabulary. Michel Kilo, who has been imprisoned by the regime, spoke about, we don't want any kind of second Israel in the Kurdistan region of Syria. So this kind of Arab chauvinism has been maintained until today, and this is very important to understand. So I spoke about the Arab colonization, the oppression, etc. For example, even in the 60s, when you had the Baath coming to power in 63 and implementing, you know, radical social policies, challenging feudals politically, socially, etc., in the Jazire, there were no redistribution of lands towards the Kurdish peasants, for example, whereas in other areas it was the case. So a lot of discriminatory history, etc. At the same time, when Hafez al-Assad came to power and the establishment progressively of a patrimonial state in Syria, you had different policies to divide and conquer, basically, the population of Syria. And you had attempts to co-opt sections of the Kurdish population. And this had different policies. For example, co-opting the Kurdish Sufi Brotherhood network. Nakhbashandiye, and you had, for example, the president, the Mufti of the Republic, that was a Kurdish, Kuftaru. And one of the other famous religious scholar that used to legitimize, you know, the massacres of the Assad regime, El-Bouti, who was also from Kurdish origin. So there was an attempt through Kurdish Sufi Brotherhood to co-opt sections of the Kurd. And also you had individuals from Kurdish background that entered the regime. You even had at one point a prime minister, but this was always on the condition that no ethnic ethnic consciousness was put forward. No talk about Kurdishness, etc.
And you also have the cooptation of various Kurdish political parties active in neighboring countries. So this was the case, you had the alliance made from the 80s with the PKK of Öcalan. And they were like given completely, free possibility to train Kurdish youth. They had a basis in Lebanon as well, in the Bekaa. They had offices in Damascus. So until the mid-90s, they were able to completely train and launch military attacks on Turkey, because you had problems between Turkey and Syria for different reasons. At the same time, you had relationship between the main two, if you want, Iraqi Kurdish political parties, the one controlled by Talabani and the other by Barzani, that were offered, if you want, asylum in Syria and be able to be active politically, and even sending some fighters as well to fight in Iraq, always on the conditions of not speaking about the Kurdish issue within Syria. So the main issue was Iraq and Turkey for these two political parties. So there was also policies of cooptation, and this has been a policy of Assad on various of Assad patrimonial state on different aspects of the Syrian population: clientelism, sectarianism, ethnic differentiation, etc. We can go into details later on this issue. But I would say that you still had resistance from Kurdish youth, local actors, political parties, especially one that was well known was Yekiti, that was established in the beginning of the 90s, various leftists, Kurdish nationalists but tended to the left, that were quite active and would be quite active also during the 2000s, seeking also collaboration with various Arab political parties, Syrian Arab political parties and opponents, trying to do gathering together, etc. And obviously the oppression continued in the 2000s with Bashar Assad, and even more against the Kurdish actors, first because you had a rapprochement between the Turkish state and Bashar Assad, and secondly, following the 2003 US-British invasion, also of Iraq, more difficult relationship with the Iraqi Kurdish political parties. So repression was very much intense, and this was notably symbolized by the Kurdish Intifada of 2004 in Qamishli, where you had mass uprising of Kurdish areas following a football game where the supporters of Deir ez-Zor city put pictures of Saddam Hussein, and others answered by saying Bush is great. Well, as wasn't really great as an answer, but what happened is that the security services allied with various Arab tribes from the region of Qamishli, Deir ez-Zor, completely let them repress Kurdish supporters and civilians, etc. But during this uprising, it was the first time in the modern history of Bashar Assad that a statue of Hafez Assad was pushed down in Amuda, a city, a Kurdish city, that would see demonstration in the first week of the uprising in 2011. So I'm going to spend a bit of time now in the 2011 uprising that started in 2011, sorry. First of all, you had a complete collaboration between the Kurdish youth and Arabic youth, and even when we speak about the northeastern areas, Assyrians as well, that is a small Christian ethnic community. At the level of similar forms of organization that you had in other regions of Syria, especially through local coordination committees, popular organizations, and most of the Kurdish political parties were not really much involved at the beginning of the protest, except two: the Future Movement, different from Lebanon, for the people that know Lebanon, led by Michel Ta'amo, and Yekiti Party. The rest were having a step behind, saying, let's be careful, we don't know what's going to happen, we're not sure about our Arab partners, etc. But they were involved very much, so they were collaboration with LCCs from other regions, Arab regions, from other different religious sects. You had really this kind of what was the case at the beginning of the uprising, an uprising that it was said, but I think it's important to repeat it, that is part of the revolution processes of the region for democracy, social justice, and equality, and in Syria as well, challenging sectarianism and racism. So you had a lot of messages, especially in the northeastern area of, you know, challenging racism, the unity of the Syrian people, written in different languages, Syrian, Arabic, Kurdish, and putting forward, especially at the beginning, different, you know, slogans showing this diversity while showing the unity of the Syrian people, and democratic also appeals, etc. This did not mean that the youth, the Kurdish youth, abandoned completely their demand, their various demands for a federal state, for the recognition of Kurdish cultural rights, etc. And for a year, I would say, this lasted until March 2012. You had collaboration between Kurdish youth and Arabic youth on a very intense basis. It continued until, and even lately, but not on the same level, and the same level of collaboration. From the beginning of 2012, we've seen increasingly, unfortunately, divisions among the youth on the issue of on the Kurdish issue, actually. And so, even in the beginning, there were, and it's important to say it because I've been, I mean, since the beginning, in support of the Syrian uprising. But we shouldn't be hiding that there were some problems within it. And the Kurdish issue was one of them, about people saying we shouldn't talk about the Kurdish issue right now, it's a factor of division, etc. And you can find similar things when it comes to women's rights issue or sectarianism, etc. Let's talk about these kind of issues, we'll see later. First of all, it's the struggle against Assad. And this has proven to be increasingly problematic on many scales. And the kind of collaboration that was happening was less and less present, unfortunately. Now I'm going to treat different things, obviously, the PYD and the Rojava issue, the relationship with the regime, the relationship with international actors, the relationship with the opposition, and finally, to conclude, because these, even though they are related, obviously, have to be treated separately, I think. At the beginning of the uprising, the regime, one of the cards to divide the Syrian people was to also try to appease Kurdish people by trying to give the nationality to some section of the Kurdish people that didn't have it. Actually, I forgot this in my introduction. One also of the means to oppress the Kurdish people was exceptional census that was made in 62 that led to 150,000 Kurdish to be, forbidden of their nationality. At the eve of the uprising, there were 300,000. When you're, actually, there were two sorts of them. There were them considered as ajaneb, foreigners, and them, and others, 150,000, the rest, without any kind of recognition. In both cases, they were not able to get, social assistance, etc. It was a very difficult situation. So at the beginning of the regime, promised we will give nationality. What happened, it didn't really give nationality, and people said, demonstrated as an answer, majority of Kurdish youth, saying it's not enough nationality, we want freedom. This was the answer of the majority of the Kurdish LCCs. But the regime continued its policy to try and divide the popular movement. And one of the cards that was used was at the beginning not to repress too severely the Kurdish areas, but after a couple of months, the repression started, much more important. And another card they started to use was the PKK that re-established in Syria in 2003 with a local branch. At the beginning of the 2000, PKK had a new policy of establishing local branches to be more involved into a national framework. So it was in Syria, it was the PYD, in Iran, it was the PJAK. In Iraq, it's a bit more difficult with the Barzani regime that is much more repressive towards the PKK. And there was kind of a common agreement that has been made at this point. The regime let PKK people come back. So the head of the PKK, Saleh Muslim, that had been in prison in Syria, was able to come back from Mount Kandil, which was a military basis of the PKK in northern Iraq. He was being able to come back. PKK was able to establish institutions, cultural houses, etc. Even soldiers. So he had a couple of thousand soldiers going back coming back in the first year. They were progressively being able to come back. While at the same time, the PKK on their medias were very strongly in favor of the revolution, inviting, you know, on their television, you know, people opposing the regime, saying we're part of this revolution, etc. Although not joining the opposition in exile, the Syrian National Council, but being part of opposition within Syria, National Coordination Committee, that was more leaning towards some form of reform dialogue with the regime, let's say. Was more, but even though they left them because there were contradictions. And progressively, they were able to have more and more important presence, if you want, in the Kurdish streets in Syria. And what happened, it served both the interest of the regime and the PKK. PKK started monopolizing the Kurdish street, even repressing sometimes demonstrations coming out from Kurdish LCCs, Kurdish political groups, in favor of the revolution. So this was the case, for example, in a Kurdish neighborhood of Aleppo, where I'm originally from, Ash-Shafir, or in Afrin, which is the stronghold historically of the PKK. And in July 2012, the regime withdrew from Kurdish majority areas, leaving them to the PKK to concentrate on other areas to repress massively. You should remember, in the summer of 2012, the regime was nearly on the brink of falling. Damascus was suffering a lot of offensive. At the end of the summer of 2012, Aleppo was cut in two, because the opposition took large areas of Syria. So they withdrew. But it was never, and this is very important to understand, an alliance, or if you want, coalition between the regime or the PKK. It was at a temporary moment, the regime could not fight on different fronts. So they withdrew and let the PKK establish their own zone. For example, in certain cities, you had the cities cut in two. Qamishli, for example, in the northeast of Syria, was divided between regime areas and PKK-held areas. And I would say between 2012 and 2016, this kind of tacit agreement of non-aggression was kept. But this did not prevent that you had, at certain occasion, conflicts between the two, fighting each other, etc., but on a very small scale, and it was more on localized basis. And the regime never said that it would grant Kurdish population any kind of rights. And since 2016, what we've seen, that the regime coming back stronger, especially following Iranian intervention, Russian intervention, gaining more strength militarily, gaining more territories, etc., reconquering any more territories, more and more pressure put on Kurdish forces, on PKK forces. And it has been crescendo since then. Threats against the PKK has been made on a repeated cases, Bashar Assad saying, listen, everyone that works with the American must be kicked out, you must return to the framework of the homeland, etc. So at the same time, PKK is, and I will explain why, feeling more and more threatened by different sides, by the regime, by Turkey, and I will come back on it, U.S. Collaboration with the PKK since 2014 is diminishing considerably, and it also was only a tactic collaboration between PKK and U.S. ally, which is, we can witness it today. Following the beginning of 2018, the Turkish forces collaborating with various reactionary Syrian Islamic fundamentalist groups is occupying until today Afrin. But you've seen also today in Minbij, which was controlled by a city that was controlled by the PKK, has come under the, after an agreement with the US, is co-ruled between the Turks Turkish army and US army. So, to resume my fact on the Syrian regime and the PKK, it was never a tacit agreement that lasted until the regime is becoming more powerful and now threatening PKK, PYD zone. There's a willingness on the side of PYD, as they're feeling more and more threatened, to seek an understanding with the regime. But this, not at any kind of price. They want a minimum of recognition of their rights, etc. It's not happening today. Until today, the Syrian regime has completely refused any kind of recognition of Kurdish rights, national rights, or federalism, etc. So this is the first thing. What about the relationship with the opposition? This, unfortunately, is a historic, historical failure, I would say, even from the Syrian Arab left to recognize Kurdish national rights. There was a party in the 80s that has worked on this issue, the Party of Labor, Party Communist Action, that recognized the Kurdish national rights that was completely repressed by the Assad regime. And they had even Kurdish members. It was a new left that was growing in the 70s and 80s, but they were completely crushed by the regime. Otherwise, we had in Syria very much a chauvinistic position towards the Kurdish issue. And this was witnessed once more, unfortunately, since the beginning of the uprising. So at the first the various Syrian opposition bodies have even refused the fact of changing the name of the country from Syrian Arab Republic to Syrian Republic. So it's a complete refusal. So just to put you in situation, racist discourse has continued until today towards Kurdish Kurdish population. Federalism has been refused. So all the demands of the Kurdish political parties have been refused. In addition to this, as the Syrian National Council was controlled since the beginning by the Muslim Brotherhood and, if you want, conservative forces allied to the Gulf countries and Turkey, the worst enemy of the PKK. So it's not the best thing if you want to establish confidence. And you had statements or discourses of officials of the SNC that could be a copy-paste of the Turkish ruling state, saying PKK is a terrorist organization, we cannot deal with it, etc. And also making statements, especially the Muslim Brotherhood, since the beginning, inviting a Turkish army to intervene in Syria, so since the end of 2011. And they have supported various Islamic fundamentalist forces launching attacks on Kurdish civilians. And this since the summer of 2012. Jabhat al-Nusra and others. And they used to call them Free Syrian Army, where everyone knew it wasn't the Free Syrian Army at the time. And also it's important, I haven't really spoken of it. But you had collaboration in the beginning between FSA forces and the PKK at different moments. We always speak about the famous Battle of Kobani. There was a statement put out by the PKK recognizing the role of the FSA within Kobani fighting against Daesh. Unfortunately, these experiences of common fight between the FSA and PKK did not last. And as Ashley said today, FSA was never a formal institution. It was a coalition of different groups with very different political orientations, and according to regions, it could be very different, yani from Arab nationalists to Islamic fundamentalists. So the relation with the opposition has been very bad until today. And this has been a big failure. And as, for me, even though PKK has made a lot of mistakes, and I will come back on the issue of the international actors, is the responsibility of the Syrian Arab left to recognize first the issue of the recognition of Kurdish national rights as a history about, you know, people being oppressed in a particular country. So the first responsibility is on this opposition of failing to recognize this. And I think this is very important to put forward. When it comes to the relationship with international actors, as you all know, there's a current alliance between the PKK and the USA, even though since, I would say, that the debate among the US administration has been increasing since the beginning of the year, now more and more seeking maybe to withdraw. And therefore, once again in history, we'll see the Kurds being abandoned after being used. But after Kobani, so there was a collaboration between US, the Kobani battle in the end of 2013-2014, there was a collaboration between the US and the PKK on the condition of only fighting the Islamic State. And this was the main reason for their collaboration. They even helped in the in naming the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is a PYD-led military force with few Arab forces in it and Assyrian forces. And you have around 2,000 US soldiers in the northeast of Syria. But most probably, as I said, we've seen the different cases, they are not there for the protection of Kurdish national rights or Kurdish people. We've seen Afrin, we've seen the referendum in Iraq, and if you think PKK is an ally of the US, PYD, Barzani is a much more ally of the US, of Israel, whoever, and no one moved regarding the Iraqi Kurdish constitution. There was also periods of collaboration between the PYD and the Russian state. At the beginning, PYD welcomed Russian intervention in Syria in 2015. And they were also in a collaboration when they conquered areas of rural Aleppo, for example, Tel Arafat, etc., where local population had to leave because of this evasion of PKK forces with the help of Russian assistance. But this relation has become more and more difficult as the regime is getting stronger, and the first ally of the Russian forces in Syria is the regime, and not the Kurds that were tactically used just as the US. So this is very important, and this is why the PKK is BYD is more and more feeling completely encircled by different forces, whether the regime, whether Turkey, international actors turning their back on them. And also this is criticism of believing you can change from above without joining the popular movement from below. That was the case at the beginning, especially in the 2-3 years. And to a similar extent, you can make similar criticism when it came during the Gezi Park movement in 2013 in Turkey. As PKK was in a peace negotiation with Erdogan, the party did not call its members to join the movement. Some did on an individual basis, but you know when PKK joins a movement, Diyarbakir in the south of Turkey is millions of people out. Istanbul is the same. So this criticism, I think I could come back. And before concluding, just on the issue of Rojava, because this is a main issue among the left, the PKK, the PYD self-administered areas, I cannot go into details. There have been very positive experiences that I think we should acknowledge. First of all, saying that a people oppressed in a particular country being able to administer their own areas, a majority Kurdish area, is something positive. I don't think it's something that we can deny. When it comes to women's rights and participation, especially in a wartime, I'm not talking about the military women, etc., because this is really, if you want to put forward, you know, women as soldiers, etc., it's also very reactionary. We can see this with Israel, etc. I'm talking about the fact they participated in institutions. They're represented at the highest level. And this is not something we can put aside again. When it comes to secularization of laws, etc. So these are very positive aspects that have to be acknowledged, especially in a war situation. And if you compare to opposition held areas, and even at the beginning, the level of participation of women, of diversity of religious and ethnic minorities were not at the same level. We have to be very clear on this. But also, it's not the new Commune de Paris or the new Bolshevik Party, as we have heard by some people, when it comes to these areas. It's a control from above, from people from the PKK. Kurdish rival actors have been repressed very severely. Independent activists, etc., have been repressed very severely. There have been attacks on some excision on Arab local populations, not ethnic cleansing, this is not true, but there have been attacks on some Arab local population in certain areas. And there are problems, for example, today in Raqqa, how to deal with certain areas, to let people back or not. So it's still very much, and this perspective of believing that you can change from above, this relationship with Russia, etc., with the regime. So it's we shouldn't sugarcoat it without having illusions, without saying is, as some people have said, especially that our own critical supporters of the Syrian revolution, part of the counter-revolution. It's very far from that. It's not true. As I said, neither counter-revolutionary or counter-revolutionary, neither Bolshevik anarchist, or I don't know what. Huh? Especially when you speak with some sections of autonomists or anarchists that criticize usually your authoritarianism in your own party, for example, ISO, etc., and they say, PKK is so fantastic, so freedom of speech. I mean, when you know the history of the PYD and PKK dealing with internal debates or internal conflicts, it's a bit different. Yeah. In conclusion, I've been a bit, I'm going to finish now. I think, I had never said this, but I think and I said it before this afternoon, revolutionary processes are something that are able to open various opportunities, challenging reactionary practices in society, challenging patriarchal codes, racism, sectarianism. I personally, and you have different person, for some person it was the revolutionary process open, you know, a feminism radicalization. I had friends, it was a radicalization during the process towards more feminism. I had a friend that before the revolution, we used to talk about civil marriage, she was against. Now she's one working with a feminist organization, challenging, you know, conservative actors in society from both sides. Mine, I think it was the Kurdish issue. I was something that opened my eyes. I wasn't really aware to this extent about the oppression of the Kurdish people in Syria. And this was really by the collaboration I had with various, I wasn't in Syria at the beginning, I mostly grew up outside after I could not go back, but with activists I used to meet from Aleppo and different solidarity thing. The Kurdish issue was something that really opened my mind, coming especially from a, I would say, long ago, Arab nationalist background, etc. And I remember the talks, even, for example, in 2004, during the Kurdish Intifada uprising in Syria, majority of the discussions we have, even among activists, was saying, you know, it's following the 2003 US-British invasion, it's part of dividing the region. And this was, maybe Youssef, you could say it as well, it was one, most of the this was the dominant discourse within Syria in 2004. This was part of the division of Syria. We didn't see it as a truly protest movement, you know, for democratization, etc. And it's important to make the links between the solidarity that had been made, especially at the beginning of the uprising, between the various religious sect, ethnicities, various people from different regions, and not have a selective solidarity, what I call. Because if you have selective solidarity, you have also a selective learning. Therefore, you cannot take all these experiences that have been accumulated for the past 7 years of revolutionary experiences of local self-administration without having this whole solidarity, with bringing the Kurdish issue, with bringing women's struggles, struggling against sectarianism, etc. So this is, I think, a key issue. And to finish, and to make a link with the Palestinian issue, is that, especially when it comes to Syria, Turkey, and Iran, the Kurdish people will not be able to be completely free, and neither these local population, without the collaboration between them. And this is a key issue. And one of the biggest, unfortunately, defeat of the Syrian uprising that opened on a massive scale the Kurdish issue in Syria is that the killing of the Syrian revolution will kill also the aspirations of the Kurdish people for change. So therefore, again, the key issue is about solidarity between the different people on a democratic and progressive basis to open real change on a regional basis and not only on Syria, because it's not only about Syria, it's about the whole region. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.